For members only, Golf Smarter number 455, published on September 23, 2014.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The 1969 Ryder Cup finish that shocked the world with author Neil Sagabell.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Neil.
It's good to be with you, Fred.
It's good to be with you. It's good to be here. It's very good to be here. I'll give you more details on that in a minute. Before we get started, though, I want to remind everyone of the last time you were on the show, episode 353 and 354, for your great book on the 1955 U.S. Open.
Yeah, thank you. It seems so long ago, but I guess it was only a couple years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it came out just in time for the 2012 U.S. Open that was played in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's right, at the Olympic Club, right. And I think that's the fifth time that they played the Open there. And the first time, of course, was in '55 when Jack Fleck upset Ben Hogan in one of the greatest upsets in the history of the game.
And that's what prompted your book, "The Longest Shot," right?
That's right.
And that book is still available on our website in our Golfer's Mark. Congratulations. It's gotten great praise because it was a really entertaining and timely story. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because this weekend we've got the Ryder Cup happening. And you've gone back in history once again to flush out a story that may not have been a big story at the time. But the 1969 Ryder Cup, what you call the draw in the dunes.
Yeah, I don't think anybody – it was an unexpected week in 1969. This Ryder Cup was not what it is today. It had all the elements, really, that it has today, playing for your country, playing match play, playing with your teammates and for a captain. But it had been pretty one-sided up until that point, and America was winning a lot. And then we had these 1969 matches – which, when I looked into this, and also even based on what else I've read, this was one of the best Ryder Cups ever played. It was
really,
and it's known, what people know it for is the ending, of course, and that's what caught my eye when I was thinking about writing another book. That famous ending with Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacklin on the final green, but.
No spoiler alerts. Don't give out the final ending. We're going to get there.
Okay.
But go ahead.
It was a great Ryder Cup, and it was a surprise to the American team that went over there. It was, again, a different era. It was a Great Britain team back then and not a European team. But it was a thrilling week, and it had everything – that you could want in a Ryder Cup that would make it exciting and great and suspenseful. There was, there was some acrimony. So it was quite a dramatic week there at Royal Birkdale.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me tell you my story about reading your book. I just got back from a week vacation. I was going down to Mexico for a week and was going to read the book while I was there. Lay on the beach and read a book. How perfect can life be? And so I started reading it, and I started getting into the background of Tony Jacklin and how you set up who he was and how he became, one of the first British players to really have an impact in the United States. I was really enjoying it, and I was just starting to get into 1969, and I also love the way you incorporate world history as place markers to what was going on to all your stories. And then just as I was about to get to the Ryder Cup, Hurricane Odile hit Cabo San Lucas, which was where I was, and we were right in the heart of it. And we got stranded. I'm a refugee of Hurricane Odile. It was an amazing and terrifying event, and it took us 3 days. We didn't get out until Wednesday. The hurricane was Sunday night, and so I didn't get to finish the book. So it's up to you, my friend, to tell me the entire story. I want to hear it now.
Well, first of all, Fred, I have to say, I'm just glad you're back at home and that we're having this conversation.
Thank you.
You and your wife are safe and you weren't injured, right?
No, luckily, none of the windows in the room we were staying in imploded like the rest of the resort. The resort that we were staying at was pretty much destroyed. I would be very surprised if they're open again for the Christmas rush. And there were people telling us, I talked to a couple hotel managers, they were telling us that it could be 3 weeks to a month before they get any electricity. And you know, there was no water, there was no sewage, and the sewage was starting to back up in the street, and there was looting and rioting, and martial law was set. It got ugly really fast. But we luckily had each other and didn't get injured and were able to make it through it. And because both of us worked in media in the San Francisco area for a long time, we still have a lot of friends who are in it. And as we got off the plane in San Francisco, there was a news crew waiting for us. And so luckily they knew that I would be the guy who has a lot of video and photos of what happened. And so I will post, there's a news story from a local TV station. There's a news story and I'll put it on our website as well to show our adventure, if that's what you want to call it.
That was quite an adventure. And actually, I saw it right before we started talking today. And I was just sort of aghast. and then I saw your email that said safely returned from Mexico. And I was so glad to hear that.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know we're going to talk about this book, but was that was that the most terrifying experience of your life?
Wow. How crazy is this that I have to think about it? A couple years ago, my wife was a victim of a car accident. She was a pedestrian hit by a car. And that may have been one of the more challenging things in my life. Because, you know, we later learned after it was all over and she made it and stuff, we later learned how close she was to not making it. But as something we experienced together, it was really frightening. It was there were definitely thoughts crossing my mind that I may not make it back to the United States. That was definitely that thought crossed my mind. And I think it would have been much worse if any of the windows imploded in our place. They actually, the first room we were in, we were right on top of the beach. It was on the fifth floor of a six-story resort. And we literally were 30 yards from the waves breaking. And they, at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, we arrived Saturday night. And by 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, they had moved us to a different room in the complex because they said it was safe. And we're like, we didn't even know this was coming. We thought there was going to be rain on Sunday night. That was the forecast. There was going to be rain. And so we moved into a different room. And we later went back and you saw on the video, you saw how we went back into that room and it was there was glass all over. And it wasn't like tempered glass. It was just, you know, little shards. I mean, little pieces of glass. It was shards of glass. And there was one person from our hotel who got very bloodied because the glass hit him and his wife broke her arm. But if the glass would have broken in our room, I think we would have freaked out a bit more than we actually did. But the sounds of it were incredible. We had 135 mile an hour sustained winds and 150 mile an hour gusts. And a lot of the construction there in that area, they used the Spanish tile roofing and the tiles were flying everywhere and they were crashing onto cars and it sounded like, you know, bottles breaking nonstop. And then at about I'm from California. Give me an earthquake any day, right? It's a beautiful day. Oops, the ground is shaking. Okay, it's over, and it's still a beautiful day. The anticipation, they're saying it's coming, so the anticipation for hours drove us crazy. And then the hours of the hurricane terrified us. And then at midnight, it got quiet. And it was very, you know, calm. And then at 12:30, it picked up again. So clearly the eye of the hurricane went directly over us. So, yeah, to answer your question, it was pretty terrifying. Yeah,
I can't even imagine it. I know friends who've been through a hurricane, but I just can't. I wouldn't want to go through that. I'm sorry you've been through it. I'm glad you're okay. And
well, I don't want to go through it again.
No.
I've been in Atlanta once and in Indianapolis once when tornado watch was happening, and we had to, you know, in Indianapolis we had to evacuate into a bunker underground, and that made me a little bit crazy, but nothing happened. And you know, a tornado, you can see the path of a tornado when, you know, when it does its destruction, but houses may get, you know, run right over, but the houses on the sides of it don't have as that kind of damage. An earthquake, most of the time on earthquakes, especially in Northern California, that's kind of built for earthquakes, that, you know, they're prepared for it. You have isolated instances. When we were in the 1989 earthquake, we were actually at Candlestick Park at the World Series. And when that occurred, we had, I think there were three major areas of destruction during that earthquake, and that was the Bay Bridge. We had just been on a half hour earlier. The Oakland area, the freeway that had collapsed, the MacArthur Freeway that collapsed, which we drove by that night and saw. And in the Marina District in San Francisco, the Ball of Fire, the fires that were in downtown. And we drove by those that night as we were leaving the ballpark. But here with the hurricane, it was everywhere. It didn't miss anything. And it went right. It surprised them. They thought it was going to go west and stay off land, but it came right up the middle of the Baja Peninsula and went up through La Paz. There was a tremendous amount of destruction. At this point, I understand they only have 5 confirmed deaths, which is really remarkable, but a lot of injury. And the rioting and the looting that took place and continued to grow until they had to declare martial law on Wednesday.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. But enough of that. I'm safe. I'm here and it's time for Golf Smarter. Thank goodness I get to do this again. I have this to do. So let's talk about your book, please. Draw in the Dunes, the 1969 Ryder Cup and the finish that shocked the world. So I'm going to just sit back and I want you to take it from the top and tell me, set up the story and then give it to me, please.
Well, without giving away the ending right off the bat, that was what caught my eye. And that was where I started looking into this. And I thought, why did that matter so much? Why that was that such a big deal? Why is it so well remembered? And why do we still see clips of it? And we'll probably see clips of it this week during the Ryder Cup coverage. Sure. Of Nicklaus and Jacklin on that final green. And so when I started researching this topic, I discovered what journalists called at that time the greatest Ryder Cup that had ever been played. And I think it's near the top of a lot of people's list even today. It was... In some ways, it resembles my first book in that you have a heavy underdog, the Great Britain team, and you have the Americans who have just been owning them ever since the early 30s. Great Britain's won once. They won in 1957 over there. In the Ryder Cup that precedes this 1969 Ryder Cup, I go into that, and you've probably read that chapter. It's second chapter. It's called Champions. I thought it was important to set up the story, not only give the context of the era, but talk about what happened in 67 at Houston. And what happened was America won by 15 points, largest margin in the history of the Ryder Cup. Ben Hogan was captain of the American side. And this is without Jack Nicklaus. They didn't even have Nicklaus on the team.
Right.
Now, they had a lot of other great players like Billy Casper and Arnold Palmer. So, and 67 was also this young man named Tony Jacklin's first Ryder Cup as well. And he had a pretty good debut, even though his side got whipped pretty handily. So in the early part of the story, I set up the what golf is like in this era,
right?
What it's like in America and what it's like in Great Britain. And now, you know, we see European players in America every week. They play on the PGA Tour. There are really no barriers to them other than their ability to play. But back then it was still very separate. And as you mentioned early on, Tony Jacklin was one of the few players from Great Britain that played on the American Tour. And it wasn't really a very welcoming tour in those days. It wasn't really set up for these foreign guys to come over and play. But Jacklin earned his way onto the tour. And this particular story, Draw on the Dunes, also chronicles his rise in golf. That year, he won the British Open in July, the first Brit to win the British Open in 18 years. Hmm. So he's the star of his team heading into Royal Birkdale, one of the 12 men. And Nicklaus, interestingly, and this has been a topic for a lot of conversation I've been having since the book has come out, is playing his first Ryder Cup, even though he's a seven-year veteran on tour. And nine of his 11 teammates are also playing their first one. So you have a bunch of rookies. And the reason for that is the PGA of America back in that day had a stipulation that you had to be a PGA professional, a member, for 5 years before you were eligible to play on the Ryder Cup team. So Jack barely missed in 67. And now he's 29 years old. He's won seven majors at this stage in his career. Not quite 30 wins on tour, and he's playing in his first, as are 10 of his teammates. And you have five rookies on the Great Britain team. I know you've got great golf fans on your show who really get into this stuff, Fred. So I'm probably going into a little bit more detail than I do on several of my interviews. But the way the teams were determined in 1969, America was determined entirely on a point system. So the top 12 players in the point standings made the team. The captain was Sam Snead. People recognize that name.
Sure.
Sam had no picks, and I'm sure it was of no concern at all to him because America always won. You know, I think they probably felt like, whether they said it out loud or not, that they could go over there with any 12 and win.
And the press treated it that way as well, right?
It was almost a non-event over here because, you know, back in that day, it was probably seen more as an exhibition from the American side of things because, as I said earlier, it had all these great elements and all this great potential, and it was pretty neat and compelling when it started. But what it lacked was competition, competitive matches, it being close, it being exciting. That was missing. So, you know, there's so many things going on in 1969, it's a little bit, there are these little cultural things I put in there to remind people of what was going on then, the Vietnam War, Richard Nixon entering the White House, the moon landing with Neil Armstrong.
Making a comment about golf when he was on the moon.
That's right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I found that in Golf Illustrated, which is a British weekly golf magazine. In fact, it's still around.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was a British publication.
Yeah. And in doing my research, I can just tell your audience, too, that a lot of it came from the other side of the pond because it just wasn't covered as heavily over here. It was probably relegated more to the back pages of the sports page. Now, it was covered. There were New York Times stories. There were some golf magazine stories, but it was very heavily covered in Great Britain, where they really loved their golf and they had high hopes for their boys, even though they lost. You know, in America that September, you're in the middle of a baseball pennant race, and the Chicago Cubs are looking like they're going to win the pennant, but they don't. And people who are baseball fans have heard this before with the Cubs.
Yeah, a couple times.
And that was the year of the Miracle Mets. And some people who were around will remember that, when they surprised everyone. They won the pennant, and then they beat the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. So, you know,
Tom Seaver.
Exactly. So it's so many things happened that year. But as it turned out, it did end up being a pivotal year in the Ryder Cup, because when they got to Birkdale, they had these great, exciting matches. The British guys played really well, and they had a very I don't know if you've gotten to this part yet, Fred, but their captain was a Scot named Eric Brown. Very fiery, competitive, win-at-all-costs mentality sort of guy. And he had been a Ryder Cup player and had actually won matches in an era when his side usually was losing. He was undefeated in singles, which was kind of an anomaly for guys on his side. And he brought a different attitude to the matches. He didn't bow to the Americans. He was like, come on, guys, we can play with these guys. We can beat them. And that was his attitude. And then you've got kind of crusty, old school Sam Snead, who doesn't believe in things like conceding putts, which sets up our ending nicely, and who has captained twice before. He's been a captain twice before, and he's making his eighth appearance in the Ryder Cup. Never lost, never been on a losing team, and there's never been a tie. So a lot of really interesting things happened that week at Royal Birkdale.
If I can take you back a moment, give me the history of how the Ryder Cup began.
Well, I'll give you the, you know, I've got that detail in the book because I wanted to give readers who aren't that familiar with it some background.
Yeah, and I thought that was so interesting.
Now, I want readers to know, I put that backstory in there, but I don't think it'll bog them down. It's right in the first chapter, and we peel back to the beginning, and I cover that, the origins of it, in about 7 pages. And I bring it back forward to 1968, 69, which is where the book starts. But it started, you know, it got its name Ryder Cup from Samuel Ryder, who was an English seeds tycoon. He sold seeds by mail. That's how he got started. And he was very successful, very industrious, and he made a lot of money. But by the time he turned 50, his health was poor. And so his doctor said, you need to get some exercise. You need to get some fresh air. And a minister friend of his, I think it was actually his pastor, said, why don't you take up golf? And I think at first Ryder said, no, I don't want to do that. But then he ended up taking up golf, and he got hooked in a hurry, and he just couldn't play enough golf.
I know it well.
And here's what's amazing, Fred, and you know it because you've read this. The man's 50 years old. He takes up the game. He hires this fellow named Abe Mitchell, he hired someone else first, but he ended up hiring this fellow named Abe Mitchell, a top player over there, a professional. And I think he pays him something like £1,000 a year to be his personal instructor. He plays and plays and plays. He plays every day, I think, except Sunday, or practices in his, you know, at his estate. And in a year, he's a 6 handicap. and he starts at 50. Now that's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, Ryder starts, he has this acute interest in golf, and somehow he ends up at these international matches, these informal matches where when the Americans come over to play in the Open Championship, which we call the British Open, they go out and play some rounds with some of the British players. And they have these sort of informal matches, but they have this international flavor. These guys that get together to play only once a year. And Ryder observed this and said, this is really a great thing. It'd be good if there was some sort of, you know, that this could be on a regular basis and there could be, you know, something more official structure to it. And this is what ended up becoming the Ryder Cup. And it's called the Ryder Cup because he donated the trophy.
And that was all he donated, was a trophy.
He donated the trophy, but he also, I think in the early stages, I think he might have, and it's in my book, so I need to read my own book, but I think he might have donated some money to help the team get to America for the first official Ryder Cup, which was in 1927. Uh-huh. But just to kind of tie a bow on this thing with his instructor, the man who sits atop the Ryder Cup trophy is Abe Mitchell, his instructor that he hired. And Abe Mitchell was really touched that he's on the trophy. He didn't really feel that he was deserved. It was a grieving honor for him to have it. But so it's all started in 27, and the official start. There's, you know, there was kind of this other sort of false start in the early 20s. But the official start, if you look back at the history, is 1927. And they trade the first four, each team winning on their home soil. And then that's when it turns into this one-sided affair. And America goes on a rampage and wins 12 of 13 heading into the 69 Ryder Cup.
And what was the difference? Why did the American team dominate so well?
You know, I think they were just better players. I do. I think golf really caught on in America. You had more people. The game really flourished. And I have to think that they were just better. But I don't know for sure. Hmm. But that's certainly the case as we approach 1969. And you look at the 50s and the 60s, it's very clear that they were better players. And they had, I think they had better competition. They had a better tour. There were all kinds of theories. And I go into this too in the book, in the lead up to the 69 Ryder Cup. And there were a lot of theories about why the British players were not that competitive with the American players.
And some of it was it style of play? I mean, obviously the parkland courses versus, you know, the why am I blanking on? Because my brain's fried.
Links.
Yeah. Thank you. Links golf. Yeah. Parkland versus links style.
No, that's very perceptive, Fred. That was one of the reasons. And I got to spend time with Tony Jacklin, which was a lot of fun.
Wow.
He understood the history of this because, well, he was born just after World War II, and he grew up watching these great British players, and he idolized them. But he told me, when he came to play the American Tour, he was trying to change his swing technique. For one thing, the courses are different here, but you also you can play all year round somewhere in America. The season's short over in the United Kingdom and Great Britain, and the weather is not as good. And Tony told me that affected things like swing technique. And at one point in history, the USGA and the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, they adopted a different ball. And I don't know, some of your audience who are old enough to remember, there was a smaller British ball. And there was a lot of talk about the Americans being better because they could play, they played with a bigger ball, which was harder to control. And then when they would switch to the British ball for the Ryder Cup, they hit it farther, straighter. They were just better. So there were a lot of theories about why America won all the time. But I think if you just had to choose one thing, their players were better.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to ask you about, I was so fascinated about the conversation about the ball in the book, because it's not that long ago that they standardized the ball. I mean, it was in the 1960s. Sure, it's 50 years ago or whatever it is ago. But still, in the history of golf, it's like there was debate on the type of ball. You know, and things are now so rigid and standard for everything. It just made me think about all this conversation that is happening today about how do we get more people to play golf? What things can we introduce? And the conversation, the most humorous and yet has some legs to it to introduce and bring in new people to the game, is this concept of the 15-inch hole, right? I'm sure you've read about this. People saying, yeah, sure, 15-inch hole, it'll cut strokes, it'll cut down the amount of time, and more people will succeed and they'll have more fun. And then I'm reading about a smaller ball and thought, well, why don't they try that?
Yeah.
I mean, they've already had a smaller ball. It's already been in play. It was on, you know, being used in Europe. And what, maybe that would be a way. And wouldn't a smaller ball fly farther anyway? And if they used today's technology with a little bit smaller, and it was not significantly smaller. It was what, 6/100ths of an inch smaller?
Yeah. It was 1.62 inches in diameter versus 1.68.
Which is the standard for today, right?
Yeah.
All right. So that's 6/100ths. So it's not that much smaller, but would that have an impact? Would that be a successful way to make scores lower?
I don't know that that would have enough impact for your average player.
Not like a 15-inch hole would.
No, not at all. And frankly, the balls today, even with them being bigger, are a lot better, I think, and a lot less susceptible to weather conditions than back in the old days when you had those bolata balls and wound balls.
Right, but the scores are not that much different.
No, that isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And the equipment's better.
Mm-hmm.
So that must say something about us, huh?
I'm not going there.
Yeah. Well, I meant the universal us, all of us golfers.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we don't have, you know, our lives don't allow us to practice as much as we'd like. And some players, but most players are not getting better, which is kind of crazy because we have all this technology behind us and we have all this mental game, which didn't exist in the 60s. You know, swing coaches were about it. Getting back to your story, what was the relationship back to 1969 of the U.S. team members? Because you had successful players and you had a coach, you know, the one who was Sneed coaching the team who, you know, refused to lose and wanted to get it done his way. Were there any animosity, contention, competition among the American teammates that created any issues?
Not that they told me later. Mm-hmm. The only real controversy was what came at the end. And there were several players on the team that were disappointed because they felt like Tony had a missable putt. He probably would have made it. He would tell you.
Are you giving away the ending now? We haven't even gotten into the tournament.
Okay. No, but there wasn't. When I talked to the players and I talked to most of the surviving players on both teams, they can just, it's just like today. Great honor to play on the team. They were excited about playing the Ryder Cup. Even America, who expected to win, to make the team was this huge honor. Ken Still said, It was the biggest honor in his life. And he said, he told me, this is 2 years ago. It's a quote that's in the book, and I might not be have it exactly right. But he said, in fact, I might be buried in the blue Ryder Cup jacket.
Wow.
They got along. And they said, most of them said, I would play with, you know, anyone on the team. Frank Beard told me that it wasn't at all like today, where there's just all this buildup and you know the captain a year ahead of time and it's talk, 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 and they're trying to figure out what players to put together, and there's these sessions of, you know, whatever, psychological stuff and pep talks. None of that in 69, just kind of old school. Let's go, you know, here we go. Here's my lineup. I asked Frank Beard, I said, what was Snead like as a captain? He said, well, it wasn't like today. He said, we might have had one meeting and it might have lasted 5 minutes. He said, he wanted to know one thing. And he said he had all of us write down on a piece of paper if there was someone on the team we didn't want to play with.
So he kept it anonymous.
Yeah. But there wasn't a lot of. Now, on the other side, Eric Brown approached it a little bit differently. But Sam Snead was just sort of, you know, is a different era. I think men related differently. They went about their business differently. And it was like, we're going to go over there and we're going to play. And there wasn't a lot of hand-holding. You know, it was – and but getting back to your question about how did the guys get along – I think they got along fine. I don't know that anybody had a problem with their teammates, but I do know Frank Beard, who was a really good player. He was the top, he was the leader on the money list that year on the American tour. Very good player. He was intimidated by the whole atmosphere, the Ryder Cup match play, playing with a teammate. He was paired with Billy Casper, who he idolized. It was hard on him, and he told me that. And I loved his transparency, and there's some great comments from Frank Beard about what it was like playing in his first Ryder Cup. He did not feel comfortable at all. He played okay, but he told me, he said, I did not really feel good about playing with Billy Casper, because people might not know this, but at that stage in the 60s, Casper was winning and was as every bit as good as anybody else on tour, including Nicklaus, including Player, Palmer, you name it. Billy Casper was a great player. And Beard was 10 years younger, and it's like, oh, I've got to play with Casper in alternate shot. Oh, my gosh. I'm worried about letting this guy down and what he's going to think of me. And so all of these things are really interesting. When you talk to these players who were great players, made a lot of money on their tours, won tournaments, how the Ryder Cup affects them is just really interesting.
So if everyone was able to get along well, I find that that fascinating, going from a sport that's, you know, all individuals all the time to a team sport and making it work, making the chemistry work, which they didn't care. It was just like point system, you're on or you're not. There were no picks. Tell me the who you got to spend time with in the research of your book, of the players. Who did you get to interview?
I really got to interview everybody I would have possibly hoped to interview, except for Lee Trevino, who was also on that team.
And why not Trevino?
He just declined. I went through his agent, and he said no. And this was early in the process. And later on, when I'd interviewed pretty much everybody else, including Jack Nicklaus, which was huge for me, I went back and I asked again, and I never heard anything. So that's the only person I really missed that would have been nice to talk to. But I talked to Nicklaus, of course. I talked to him toward the end. Frank Beard, Ken Still, Billy Casper, Raymond Floyd, who is also a Hall of Famer. That was his first Ryder Cup, and he is a vice captain this year for Tom Watson. Gene Littler and Tommy Aaron. So Dan Sykes was on that team. Some of your audience might remember him. He's deceased. And so was Dave Hill. And Dave Hill, he died a couple years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. People are going to they're going to love the stories about Dave Hill in this book. Dave Hill is quite a character and very temperamental guy. And there's some things that happen. You haven't got to them yet in the book yet, Fred, but in this Ryder Cup, you probably have the most acrimonious match in the history of the Ryder Cup.
Really?
And yeah. And I won't go into it. But I can, well, I don't know how much you want me to give away, but I can tell you this. There was almost a fist fight on Friday in a four ball match.
Between?
And that's not, and I'm not embellishing, it almost came to blows. There were a series of incidents in this match between Dave Hill and Ken Stilfer, the Americans, and Brian Huggett and Bernard Gallagher for Great Britain. Now, Huggett and Gallagher, they're still around. In fact, I don't know about this year, but Bernard Gallagher does commentary for the Ryder Cup over there. And he was a great Ryder Cup captain. He followed Tony Jacklin in the 80s, and he was Ryder Cup captain, I think, three times for his side. So he was a great player. But in 1969, he's a 20-year-old. He's the youngest man to ever play in the Ryder Cup in 1969. And he's almost kind of a Rory-type figure, although I wouldn't say he's quite at that level. But he comes onto the scene in 1969, and he's winning tournaments, and he's kind of brash, and he's a really good player. So anyway, you have these four guys, as Brian Huggett told me in his interview, he said he called all of them, including himself, feisty. And they have quite this match on Friday. All kinds of things go on. You couldn't make it up.
Wow. Were there any of the people that you had the chance to speak to, were there any surprises or any, what's the word I'm looking for here, stories that were, they conflicted with one another, that you needed some more substantiations? Like, wait a minute, you're telling me one story and you're telling me a completely different story.
There's always some of that, I think, when you do a historical
sure
book. And I learned that when I did The Longest Shot. I think the hardest thing to sort out was this match I'm starting to talk about that people will read about, because even to this day, the players in this four ball match that became a big disagreement, they still don't really agree on what happened. and so, you know, I interviewed Ken Still, and I couldn't interview Dave Hill, and I interviewed Brian Huggett and Bernard Gallagher, and I thought, and then I had the reporting from 1969 of what happened. And I remember when I was writing that chapter, I was thinking, how am I going to write this? Because there's a part of you that wants to get to some account that you say, I think this is what happened, but you don't know. So I ended up putting it all together and just reporting on what was reported at the time and what the players said later. And, It's really interesting. The other thing that you have going on when you do books like this, and I had this with Jack Fleck, is you talk to players 40 years later, and their memories of it don't always coincide with what the reporting was at the time. And so then you have to figure out how to write it.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of times what happens is they don't remember, you know, they've played a lot of golf through the years and they don't remember, but maybe a few things that happened that week. But you'll find some players who have very vivid memories. Ken still remembered a lot. It was his only Ryder Cup, and it was one of the big moments in his whole life. You could just tell from talking to him. So it's interesting and challenging to sort all of that out when you try to put together your narrative.
Sure, sure. And that was the only place that there was like people had differing views of what actually happened.
Yeah, it really was. I didn't really run into any other areas where I thought it's a big problem area. I was really glad. One of the things about this book, and it's in my author's note at the beginning, and it's been written up in some of the reviews that have come out on the book. The Wall Street Journal reviewed it a week or so ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was nice. And some other golf magazines and publications have reviewed it. And one of the things they pointed out, because I have this in the book, there was only 3 minutes of footage that survived. This event was televised by the BBC, and it was also on radio. And after writing The Longest Shot, which took place in 1955, there was very little film of that, which was not surprising because golf on TV was just getting started.
Right.
When I picked up this story, I thought, oh boy, I'm going to be able to watch a lot of this because it was televised. I inquired with the BBC. They pointed me to IMG, the big agency that represents athletes. They own the rights to that particular Ryder Cup. Somehow they acquired the rights. So I had to go through them and try to find any archived footage of the 1969 Ryder Cup matches televised by the BBC. Well, what I come to find out is there are only 3 minutes. And I was surprised by that. So I had the challenge again of putting this together without the benefit of really any television coverage. But the good thing about it was the 3 minutes that they have was the ending. And by being able to watch the ending, which is the climactic moment in the book, I can really sort of slow things down. And I picked out a lot of the details that I watched on film to describe what happened. And when you can see things on film, you know that's true. That's factual. You're not relying on someone's memory. You know, Jack Nicklaus told me he picked his ball out of the cup on the 18th hole, which was the way he remembered it. I mean, that's what players normally do. But when I watched the film, he didn't do that. He didn't pick his ball up. He sank a 5-foot putt. And then instead of reaching over and picking his ball out of the cup, he reached down and picked up Tony Jacklin's marker for that famous concession. And I don't know who got his ball, but you know, it's nice when you have some of that because you can actually describe what happened and know that was factual.
Had you watched the footage before you got to do that interview?
I think I had seen that footage, and I didn't try to correct Jack's memory, but in the cases where I had some other source, you kind of weigh your sources, and you have to decide, well, what do I think really happened here? Or in some cases, you just report both versions. And let the reader decide. You know, the readers are smart, and you give them, you just give them enough, and they can draw their own conclusions from situations.
All right, so let's go back now and go over the matches, not each individual match, but each day of what happened and how it got to the point where it was that close and had that dramatic of an ending.
Well, I'll just quickly tell the format. It was the same as today. You started with foursomes on the first day, which is alternate shot. I think your audience will know what that is. The second day was four ball matches, which is better ball, best ball, and the last day was singles. So that is just like it is today. This was the first Ryder Cup to have 12-man teams. We have 12-man teams today, but in 1969 was the first year of 12-man teams. Before that, they had 10-man teams.
Oh.
But what was different about 1969 is when people read the score of that match, it of course, it ended in a tie. That's why it's called Draw on the Dunes. It was the first tie in the history of the Ryder Cup. The score was 16-16, and that'll strike people as a little odd. They'll say, well, wait a minute. 32 points. I thought the Ryder Cup is 28 points. And it is now. In 69, they had two sets of singles on the final day, the morning session and the afternoon session. Eight matches in the morning, eight in the afternoon. So you had 32 points in that day instead of 28. What happened, just as this fiery Great Britain captain, Eric Brown, had hoped for, he exhorted his players. He knew that in the past they'd always gotten behind, and he wanted to get out fast every morning. Well, this is what happened. The first day, Great Britain got out in the first session. They were after the end of the first session of the morning. They were ahead, I think, 3.5 to 0.5 points. And he was just, he was beside himself with joy. They were way out ahead in front. And so this established really the pattern for the week. Great Britain got out ahead. In the afternoon, the Americans were playing catch up. And in the afternoon of foursomes, America came back. And they, at the end of the first day, it was 4.5 to 3.5. The Americans won the second foursome session on Thursday. They go out on Friday, and again, Great Britain wins that session 2.5 to 1.5, and they're ahead 7-5. But then in the afternoon four balls, America wins that session 3-1. So we go into the final day, and it's all tied up 8-8. And America's kind of got the pressure on them now. It's like these guys are – they might beat us. They're playing really well. You have more matches that are going to the final hole probably than ever in the history of the Ryder Cup. And I think in total there were 17 of the 32 that went to the final hole and five that finished on the 17th. So these are really close, tense matches. The last day you have the singles. And in the morning, just like the previous days, Great Britain wins the morning session 5-3. They're ahead 13-11. The galleries now are really, they're really fired up because they think we can win the cup. You go into the afternoon, and they need 3.5 out of a possible 8 points to take back the cup for the first time since 1957 and for only the second time since the Great Depression. America's backs are to the wall. And you have Tony Jacklin and Jack Nicklaus playing the anchor match. And this is both in the morning session and the afternoon session. In the morning session, Jacklin beats him 4-3. Jacklin is the best player at Royal Birkdale this week. Jack Nicklaus misses a bunch of short putts in that morning session. Not really at the top of his game. So they anchor the match, the second session as well, and it comes down to their match, and it comes down to, you know, the final hole. Everything is tied. And their match is tied. So it comes down to the very, very end.
Wow. Yeah.
So we know what happens. I mean, people who pick up this book, who've heard about this, they know that something happened on this final green. It's known as the concession. It's a famous moment in golf. in sports, this great act of sportsmanship. So the context for that, you know, now we have some of the context for that. These close matches, some acrimony. I haven't really talked much about this, but it was for the Americans, they felt like the galleries at time were hostile. It's been a tough week. Mm. Now you have Nicklaus and Jacklin coming down the final fairway. You have both teams gathered around the green and their captains, and you have 10,000 spectators. It's the wind's blowing and it's spitting rain, and it's about 6 o'clock in the evening at Royal Birkdale after this long week. And they hit it's a par five hole. It plays downwind, easily reachable in two, and they hit their approach shots up on the green. Jacklin is farther away. He putts first. He has about a 30 footer for an eagle. And he rolls it up. It's tracking right for the hole, and it stops about 2 feet short, and he marks his ball. Jack's got about a 20 footer, and his putt now is to win the Ryder Cup. It's also for an eagle. Jack is a very deliberate player, as some people will remember, and he took his time, and it's very tense. People around the green are just waiting for Jack to hit this putt. He hits it, and This is part of it that what's on film. It misses, and unlike Jack, he hit it pretty hard, and it rolls almost 5 feet by the hole.
So he's still away. He's still hitting.
He's still away. Now, when I'm in Jack Nicklaus's office interviewing him, I asked him about that putt. I said, Jack, you knocked that 5 feet by the hole. I said, what happened on that putt? Do you remember anything? You know, where did you see Tony come up short and you were trying to make it and you hit it too hard? And he kind of laughed and he said it was probably just stupidity. He said, you don't want to leave a putt like that for the whole match is hanging on a putt like that. Now, he's missed a number of putts shorter than that in the morning match. So Jack is really taking his time looking this one over. And people in the gallery are, one person faints. That's how nerve-wracking it was.
Wow.
So then we have the big moment. Jack grinds over this putt, and he finally gets over it. And, you know, like the Golden Bear did when he needed one, he knocked it in. And then in that moment, he reached down and he processed all this sort of what was happening and what he realized, what was at stake. The fact that Jacklin's putt was for a tie, not a win. And the fact that with a tie, America retains the cup. And the fact that Tony Jacklin was a new British Open champion and a hero over there. And if he somehow didn't get that 2 footer in, as Jack has said, it might kill his career. Jack somehow calculates all this in the moment.
It would kill Jacklin's career.
Exactly. It would kill Jacklin's career. Or it would do serious damage to him to miss a putt like that on his home soil to tie the Ryder Cup. And Tony is resolute. He will tell you he would have made that putt, and I bet he would have.
Oh, sure.
And all his teammates.
He said it was a 2 footer, right?
It was a 2 footer.
Okay.
Give or take maybe a couple inches. But what all the players were unanimous on was he probably would have made it, but it was missable under the circumstances. It was not a gimme. If it were a gimme, then the concession really doesn't mean anything, and it wouldn't be the big deal it is today. So Nicklaus concedes the putt. And they shake hands. Jack has some nice words for Tony on that green. And they walk off the green arm in arm. The gallery's applauding. Henry Longhurst is announcing on BBC. And, you know, fade out. It was this great moment in golf. But as we talked a little bit, I think maybe we alluded to earlier, it was controversial with some of his teammates, and certainly his captain at that time.
Oh, sure. Sure. What was the relationship between at the time between Jacqueline and Jack?
Well, that's an interesting part of it too. I should tell say that one of the great, I mean, including spending time with them, a great part of this project for me too was asking and having them collaborate on the foreword for this story, which is In Draw on the Dunes. So the foreword of the book is by Jack Nicklaus and Tony Jacqueline. And in that, they say, and you know, how they were friends. They were friends. And this is the interesting thing about Jack Nicklaus. He's this great competitor who would play to win and won a lot, but he also had this maturity about him and this grace to where he did something on that green that I don't know if any of the other players would have thought of to do, and that was to concede that putt. And he felt like that was the right thing to do, and that the Ryder Cup ending in a tie was a good thing. And I think he turned out to be right about that. Although, you know, people are certainly, it's debatable. You know, I've been asking the question in social media and elsewhere, you know, and Sam Snead didn't believe in giving a putt like that, that someone could have missed. They still could have won. But I think for the Ryder Cup and for reviving interest, for tapping into that spirit of sportsmanship, I think is a part of how the whole thing got started with Samuel Ryder, the international goodwill. I think that what Jack Nicklaus did was indeed a great gesture. And I think that's why it's still remembered and talked about today.
It's an amazing story. I am so glad that you dug it up and flushed it out the way you have. It really is a phenomenal story. What is there a record of how Sam Snead felt about the concession? Knowing that he wanted to win as the captain?
Yeah, there is. He never liked it.
Wow.
And I talked to Jack about that. Jack knew it. The other players knew it. Of course, Sam died in 2002, so I was never able to talk to him. But there is a quote in the book, in the aftermath chapter, that's attributed to Sam. That was, I picked up from another source, and it's a well-known quote. I've seen it in other places, where he said, we didn't come over here. It's something like, and I don't have it handy right now, but it's something like, we didn't come over here to be good old boys, and I would never give a putt like that to anyone except maybe my brother. That's the gist of it. It just went against his philosophy. And Jack understood that. He told me when I interviewed him last year, he said, you know, that was just Sam's mode. He said, I accept that. Sam was a great player and a great competitor. He said, now, I don't know that when it was all over and it was a tie, I don't know that I felt like he should have been as upset about it as he was. But the captain and the players, even then, even with their disappointment, I think they had a lot of respect for Jack Nicklaus, because Jack said Sam never said a word to him about it. Not one word. Yes. At that time or until he died, Sam never said anything to him. And Jack's teammates never took him aside and said, Jack, what were you thinking? Why did you do that? They were, you know, they admitted they were disappointed. Tommy Aaron told me that. He said, I was shocked. Billy Casper told me that. He said, we were disappointed at the time. But he said, you know, they all eventually got to a place through the years where they could look back on that and say, that was a good thing. And that was a good thing for the Ryder Cup.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you for this story, and thank you for bringing it out as much as you have. I appreciate it, because I know you want people to read the book, but I think a tease like this is going to make them want to pick up this 280-page book and read it, especially this week, you know, to put it all in context with watching the Ryder Cup. What do you think is your next project?
You know, I don't know.
Really?
I don't know, Fred, but I hope there is another one because I really enjoyed this. And one thing I, you know, we started talking about the players, and I really got off on the American team. But I think one of the things too that people will like about this is the British players are not as well known, but you get to know them in this book. So
absolutely,
people know of Tony Jacklin, but some of the other players that they'll meet in this story, they may have heard of, they may have known that they were captains at one point. One player in particular that a lot of people who are golf fans will know, he's still around, is Peter Allis, the great commentator for the BBC. He is in this Ryder Cup. It's his last one on the British side. And you have some other great players like Neil Coles and Christy O'Connor. Of course, I mentioned Brian Huggett. So I think Brian Barnes, some people might recognize that name. So I think getting to know the players was a lot of fun. And I didn't know the British side as well until I interviewed them and wrote about them. But I hope to do another book. And if anybody has some ideas, send them my way.
Will do. Send them to me and I'll make sure that Neil gets them. That's a great way to go. Well, the video of that final hole is available, and I will put that on the website as well to tease you just a little bit more about this story.
That's great.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's great. And I got right to the 18th hole with Nicklaus and Jacklin coming down to the end. But there are some things that happen in that final half hour, 45 minutes that are pretty amazing, and people will get into them. There's a player who thinks he has a putt to win the Ryder Cup before Jacklin and Nicklaus get to that final green, and he has good reason to think that. There's a lot of drama in that final hour of the 1969 Ryder Cup, and I detail that in Draw in the Dunes.
Awesome. Well, again, it's Draw in the Dunes, 1969 Ryder Cup, and the finish that shocked the world by Neil Sagabelle. Neil, I not only appreciate you alerting me that this is happening and getting it to me before the book came out to the public. Unfortunately, bookus interruptus by a hurricane. But I hope everyone comes to Golfers Mart on our website and go into our book section. You will find this and you will find Neil's other book about the longest shot. Neil, it was great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward. I hope it's not another 2 years before we get to tell another story.
Me too. I really enjoy it, Fred. Thanks for having me on, and enjoy the Ryder Cup. And I hope the U.S. can win this time.
Listen, now that Neil's offline, there's a crazy epilogue to my harrowing days in Cabo that I needed to share with you. If you remember, I mentioned I was headed down to Mexico, that I was going to be playing the one and only at the Palmia. I had my round scheduled for Tuesday. I'd been communicating with their general manager and their director of marketing. In fact, we were exchanging emails till a few hours before Hurricane Odile struck the area and we lost all the power. Well, clearly I didn't get to play, but we will get someone from that course on the show when communication is restored, because I'd like to hear how they're dealing with that crisis and what damage they incurred. Well, as I usually do on vacation, I play just once. Maybe I play twice, but usually only once. I was so rattled by this storm and its aftermath that as soon as we got home on Friday night, my wife and I both agreed that we really needed to bring some normalcy, some sense of normalcy back in our lives. And for her, that's like nesting around the house, cleaning up, just hanging out. For me, it was being on the golf course. So I played first thing Saturday morning after I returned with my best friend, and we played at Indian Valley here in Novato. Indian Valley only has one flat hole. I decided I was too tired to walk the very hilly 7 miles that we took out a cart. What happened next was crazy and magical. Number 9 and 10 are both severe downhill tee shots. When we got to number 9, I was 2 over par. which is good. I was playing well. I was sinking the short putts that have been tormenting lately, and not getting too excited about anything and not overamped about anything. Anyway, so when we got to number nine, I pulled out the driver, which always tempts the end of the fairway when I hit it well there. But this time I drove over the fairway and into a gully of very deep rough that's about 8 feet below the surface of the green. I can hear in my head another friend that I play with regularly saying, "That's too much club for you. Put the driver away." Well, his voice continued to get louder and louder as I struggled to find the ball in that gully. Just as I was about to give up, I stepped on the ball, and it was covered in 5 to 6 inch grass. Luckily, the flow of the grass was headed toward the green. So I pulled out my 60-degree score golf wedge and took a firm but easy swing. The ball landed softly, rolled, hit the stick, and dropped in for an eagle. Now I'm back to par after nine holes. Next, on number 10, another severe down hole. It's about 300-yard par four with a blind tee shot to the green. Easily 100-foot drop between tee to green and probably more. Anyway, for the first time ever, I launched the drive and it plugged the green on a fly. Again, it took me a couple of minutes to find it because we didn't think that little white thing was actually a ball. But when I got close, I realized it was the top third of the ball. It plugged so deep. So after a good lag, you know, cleaned it up, fixed the divot, then I had a good lag putt and a 5-footer. I birdied number 10. So now I went eagle birdie on two consecutive holes. Crazy! But of the 5 bogeys of that day, 3 were on par threes. Anyway, I ended around with an all-time low score of 74, just 2 over for the day. Hurricane? What hurricane? It was amazing. Hey, some good news if you're on the fence about getting a game golf for yourself. That 10% discount being offered to Golf Smarter members has gone so well that John McGuire has authorized us to extend the discount to November 1st, 2014. Then that's it. Never again. There's not going to be any more discount. So you better act now. Now, the other day, we had some friends over after we got back. This was planned well in advance. We had some friends over from out of town for dinner. Luckily, he was a golfer, lifelong golfer. So the conversation continued about golf and our week and golf and my day. So I had to turn him on to the game golf. He listened with great interest and finally said, "So how has the game golf helped your game? And how will that improve my success at those damn 40-yard shots?" I thought about it for a while. How did it help my game? I explained that the information and statistics provided by my game golf unit helped me eliminate the 40-yard shot by, 1, making better club selections, and 2, by reviewing my approach shots outside of 100 yards. And you can get that specific. You can get even more specific than that. I learned that I'm landing 40% of my shots inside 15 yards. These approach shots outside of 100 yards. 40% of them are coming inside 15 yards. But 33%, a third of my shots outside of 100 yards, are coming up short. And only 6% are going long. So now I'm taking an extra club for most approach shots, and I'm getting better results. All this is because of the stuff I've learned from using the game golf. If any of this rings true for you too, then you should seriously consider getting a game golf for yourself. Remember, Golf Smarter is the only place that you can take advantage of this additional 10% off of the newly lowered price of $199. So the new price is only, what, $180? You only have till November 1st to click on Game Golf Ad on the homepage at golfsmarter.com and make sure you use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER to secure the discount. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.